Welcome to season 4 of the Fit Farming Food Mom Podcast. Connie is a world champion powerlifter, former bodybuilder, and an elite trainer and nutrition coach. As a movement enthusiast and health nerd, she is here on this show to speak with educated guests and dive into the realm of all things health, fitness, mindset, and everything in between. If you enjoy this show, please do us a huge favor by smashing the like or subscribe button and leaving a review. Now, let's get to the show.
Hey friends, welcome back to another episode. Today I have a fabulous episode with Dr. Bill Campbell, who is a professor and director of the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory in the University of South Florida. And they are focusing on all of this research that improves exercise performance and physique enhancement within a maintainable lifestyle. So this means things that are maintenance and that are sustainable. So lots of research. He's an author, and we have a lot of great things to talk about on the podcast today. This podcast is fire. I really enjoyed talking with him, and he even turns the tables and starts asking me a ton of questions. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode. Here we go. All right, Bill, the man. I am so excited to have you on the podcast. This is a huge one for me. I have been a huge fan for a long time, and you have some amazing research out there, basically about the metabolism and like you were talking about, you're researching rapid fat loss strategies, and we were talking about how muscle is really important for our metabolism, and we dove into a whole bunch of things before we even jumped on here. So I'm super excited to have you joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. And I am studying rapid fat loss strategies, but how to do them appropriately.
Right.
It can be a lot of damage, a lot of a train wreck if we don't do them correctly.
Well, and I would love to talk about that because I think that's a huge thing that our listeners can benefit from. But first, who are you? What got you doing the things that you're doing and interested into this kind of research?
So I'm a professor of exercise science, and I direct a research laboratory called the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory. And this is at the University of South Florida, which is in Tampa. And this is kind of my second career. When I was in my 20s, I used to sell herbicides and pesticides. So weed killers and bug killers is what I did. And I didn't really love killing weeds. Didn't get up with a lot of energy to kill weeds, but I did get up with energy to exercise and try new diets. So as I got a little bit into my mid-20s, I said, hopefully I have a long time to live. I need to do something that I love. So I went back to school, and fast forward, 25 years later, here I am running my own lab. And my research, I like to say that my research helps people optimize their physiques within a maintainable lifestyle.
I think that's a big thing, Bill, because a lot of people don't find that maintainable word in their optimization quest, right? And I'm sure that's also another thing that you see is like you have bodybuilders where they are doing these unsustainable things for long periods of time, or you have people that are more general population that are doing these unsustainable things. And then what happens to them? They end up dropping it and gaining weight back or forgetting their quest to be in better shape altogether. So I think that's a huge thing.
Yeah. And that's very sad if people get to the point where they stop trying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing that I see is just constantly switching from this to this, to this. And I think that's just really an impatience, which again, I struggle with. I'm not above that. I get impatient, and nobody knows better than me, but yet there I am. I struggle with the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think that's another thing too. I think people think that if you are somebody in the fitness space and you are somebody in the health space, that it's just easy for you, but not, it's not easy for them, but it's easy for you, and that you just love to do what you do every day. And sometimes that's not the case. We all have the same issues that everybody else does, right? We just have kind of developed habitual things that we bring into our life and we know that are important as far as longevity goes.
Yeah, and that's funny you said that. There are some fitness professionals that do love exercising. I am not one of them. I think just the older I'm getting, it takes a lot for me to stick to my program. But that to me is a little bit of a superpower, because I can I have empathy for people like me who they're not always just, revolving their day around their exercise. Like I did when I was in my 20s and 30s, of course. Mm-hmm. That's, if I'm going wherever I'm doing, or it's like, okay, where's the gym? What am I doing? And then life and in my case, research and writing books and things becomes almost more important. Mm-hmm. So I would say now I'll just get into the weeds here for a moment. I hate squats, but yet I love squats. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't want to do it. It's going to hurt. I don't want to put the weight on my back. But when I'm done, I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. So it's something psychological. Yeah, and I will squat hopefully until the day I die. And I will probably hate squatting until the day I die.
I can relate with you 100% on that. I actually just talked about it on a previous podcast. we don't necessarily love these things. Like, I just started working with a new coach after my last powerlifting meet, and we're doing a lot of stuff that I don't normally do. And it has been challenging. And I was doing reverse barbell lunges the other day, which those are terrible. Ooh. And the whole time I was like, this sucks. I hate this. Why do I even do this anymore? And I was all pissed off, And then I had to flip the script. I was like, literally, if this is this hard, I probably need it. And it's probably going to carry over to my squats and everything else. So you have to kind of change that narrative in your brain too, I think, to be like, okay, this is going to pay off.
Yes. Yep.
So, yeah. Well, we started with the research of rapid fat loss strategies and doing it the correct way. So I think more than likely, is there a correct way? Because I feel like the fitness professionals feel like there's a push and pull when it comes to rapid fat loss. You can push for it, but then you've got to pull back and start to reverse a little bit, and then you can continue on with that process. What are you discovering in your research?
So when you ask me the question, is there a right way? 2 years ago, I would have said no. Just don't even consider an aggressive fat loss phase. There's just no benefit that can come from it. Mm-hmm. I, since that time, have done a research study in my lab, where hopefully we'll get it published soon. I've read some other research, and my opinion has changed. What hasn't changed is crash dieting, horrible. You don't want to do rapid fat loss strategies or embrace crash dieting for extended periods of time. The outcome is essentially like a train wreck. You will be in a worse place physique-wise than you were before you even started. I can cite multiple studies in humans. Where I have changed my mind is, if you're going to be very aggressive, I think there's a place for that, as long as it is very short. And I mean days, and up to probably a maximum of about 14 days. So it's the length of these things that where the harm is introduced. And I kind of think about it like this. When is somebody most motivated to diet? And usually it's the first week, the first day. Like, hey, they gain weight and they're really motivated. They're excited about, hey, finally having a plan that I can follow and I can lose some of this excess body fat that I have. So I think it makes sense, and I'm not an exercise psychologist, so I'll say that now. But I think it makes sense. Let's leverage this high level of motivation with a capacity to being able to tolerate and a very low calorie intake for a few days right at the start. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't only make sense to me conceptually. We have research in people with obesity that reported that people who experience early weight loss, or I like to say fat loss success, are more likely to maintain that weight loss and adhere to their diets over the next several months. So there's also a scientific reason to be aggressive at the start and then back off. And I'll explain this as an example. We did a rapid fat loss study in my lab, and I kind of went along and did the same thing the other subjects were doing. And what I did was for myself, I reduced my calories by 40%, no, 50% the first, let's just say 40%. No, it was 50% the first week. So I was typically eating 3,000. I went down to 1,500 calories for the entire week. And then in the second week, I reduced my calories to 25% of a caloric deficit. So 50% the first week. And then I increased them, but it was still a 25% caloric deficit. So guess what in that second week? Guess what a 25% caloric deficit didn't feel like to me? It didn't feel like a deficit at all because I was just coming off of a huge deficit. I was perceiving this as I'm getting to increase my calories. But if I had started there, I would have been just as miserable as anything else. Here I am dieting. So I also love it from that. So if we start aggressive for a very short period of time, anything else after that is perceived much different than if we had started from a less aggressive place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take this one step further then. So say that you are working with a client that has already got a history of dieting and probably some metabolic adaptation. Obviously, when you very first start working with somebody, they want to get immediate results. And I'll give you an example of this. Say somebody coming out of a bodybuilding show that has had a terrible rebound, okay? That's a great example. How would you, in order to keep someone's motivation high, is there any way you would recommend doing something like this with somebody like that? Or would you say directly into reverse dieting phase?
Yeah, I think in this case, and this is where you're more of an expert than I am, because you're probably working with some of these clients, but people like you have, because I've never done research on these, on people that are maybe have had very, a lot of aggressive and perpetual dieting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think in this case, we're doing more harm than good by, hey, let's diet you harder to get you started.
Yeah.
I think it's more, at least what I'm learning from my network is the exact opposite, or maybe not the opposite, but actually slowly increasing calories, getting them back to a place where they are in a position that they should diet again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you brought that up. This is not a one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
This is having the sensitivity as a coach to understand where is this person coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And I can appreciate, of course, they want to jump right in again, but that's probably not best. Or if you want to do that, go to somebody else.
Right.
I don't want to be part of this because it's not the best plan for you, given what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that happens to be a lot of the people that I work with these days, is people that have used basically bodybuilding as a diet in it, essentially, right? And when they gain weight again, they improperly reverse, and then when they gain a ton of weight immediately, they panic and they're like, well, maybe I'll just sign up for another show and that'll get me lean. And that works for two shows, maybe three, and then that person gets into such a large hole, they end up almost obese at that point.
Oof.
And it's crazy how it builds. I see it build over the course of shows with these people when I go back and look at their history. This would be a fun research project for you, Bill. but you see it build. I feel like traditionally what I see is the first show, they have a little bit of a hard reverse, but they feel fat because they were stage lean. And once you see yourself that way, you have a hard time coming back from that. So then they decide to do another show. They do another show and then they really rebound hard. And they're like, they are now in a huge deficit and they can't even hardly reverse without gaining a lot of weight. And then by the third time they decide to do a show, if they get to that point, they can gain a significant amount of weight because they are so downregulated. And it's almost like the body is like, oh, I remember what we're doing here and we're not doing this. So it like it wants to hang on to even more. And I find but, yeah, go ahead.
Was I'm anticipating that what you're seeing is their body's not even responding to what used to cause fat loss.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Wow, that's very unfortunate.
Yeah. And so by the time they do a third, if they do a third show, and typically that's when everything peaks out, I feel like they do a third show and it's almost hard to even reverse them. I've had clients that are bodybuilding clients that we've done things very responsibly. And even then it still gets hard to reverse them. You can do it, but the body is like, yeah, as soon as you ask for a little bit of fat loss, sometimes it's hesitant, you know? Anyway, if they don't do it responsibly, they end up gaining like 50 pounds or more. And at that point, it is very difficult. It takes me about a year to reverse all of that adaptation and to begin to slowly ask for fat loss, you know, in the future.
And your approach is to generally slowly just try to increase calories.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of psychological comforting and empathy, and because that's a hard sell to a lot of people.
It's a very hard sell. And I tell people before they even start working with me, I'm like, listen, this is going to take a year and we will not be asking for fat loss. Because if you do, you're just going back into a negative cycle again. So I feel as though you need to actually be like, okay, where are we at for calories? Make a baseline of calories right there. And then slowly titrate it up. And typically that person's going to gain a little more weight, which tends to, and I warn them about that ahead of time, it tends to give them a panic button, right? But the thing is you have to let everything level out and let the body know you're not going to take away from it. You see what I'm saying?
Yep, yep.
So anyway, that's why I was curious if you had any experience with that.
No experience in the person who... at least not that I know of. Again, I'm not coaching. I'm recruiting subjects for studies.
Right.
What I will be doing though is in the future is doing a much more of a focus on middle-aged women. So I'm going to get outside the realm of competitive female bodybuilders, but these women that are going through perimenopause who are kind of having the same problem. I am trying, I'm dieting. And I want to document this. I want to say you are in low calories and you're not losing body weight. Mm-hmm. And then that's now documented. And again, the only way to do this, I think, is in a case study. Mm-hmm. And then whether it's, like you're saying, reverse diet for a period of time, maybe it's HRT, but start learning about the strategies that can help, because I see this. I'm getting a lot of messages from women, again, not necessarily, maybe they were bodybuilders when they were younger, mm-hmm. but just these, I'm going to call them fitness females who do everything right. Mm-hmm. And it's just the body is not responding like it used to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can't wait for that study because that's a good one. So that can lead us down another rabbit hole though. Let's talk about metabolic efficiency, because I think a big mistake when people begin to diet is they slash calories too much. And in my opinion, and this is where we've got you and we can talk about this, is our muscle is king. Our muscle is what makes it so that we are burning large amounts of calories doing nothing. And so I feel like when people go into a large deficit immediately, their body begins to burn their lean tissue and prioritize that instead of fat, because it is expensive to run that.
Yeah. So if somebody's reducing their calories substantially for extended periods of time, this is where my new thinking has gone at this. And by extended periods of time, more than a few weeks,
mm-hmm.
And in some cases, maybe even more than a few days. Yes, the research is very clear. And there's everything about a caloric deficit, and especially the more severe, is working against all of your efforts to build and maintain your muscle. So real quick, I'll just rattle off some research. Even a modest caloric deficit of 20% suppresses resting muscle protein synthesis by about 20%. The same diet, a 20% caloric deficit, which is not severe, has been shown to, in males and females, significantly increase muscle protein breakdown. Those are cellular data. Now let's look at some systemic data. a 45% caloric deficit. So now we're looking at a pretty aggressive diet. This disrupts the growth hormone, the GH-IGF-1 axis. Essentially, growth hormone gets converted and produces or stimulates the production of IGF-1, which is an anabolic hormone. This happens in the liver. When we're dieting, that conversion stops. Our body will still keep producing growth hormone, but we produce less and less IGF-1, and then that's a form of anabolic resistance. That's been shown in males and females. So now we have cellular, we have systemic, and multiple studies showing the actual losses of lean tissue when we have severe caloric deficits for more than just a few days at a time. What's the end game here? A loss of muscle. And the end game is a hyperphagic response when you're done dieting. That means when you're done with your diet, you now have an appetite that is insane. And this insane appetite called hyperphagia, the end game there is body fat overshoot, which you mentioned some people gaining, you know, even 50 pounds or 30 pounds. What happens is in a very short period of time, you have gained more body fat than what you had before you started dieting to begin with. Mm-hmm. All of this can be prevented if you maintain your muscle mass when mm-hmm. dieting.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that a lot of people are missing when it comes to their ideologies as far as what it takes to lose weight, right? What a lot of people think that it takes cardio to lose weight and that you need to go into a deficit and that weight training is not important. However, we know the studies show something quite different than that. They show that we should be building more muscle mass and maintaining that so that our basal metabolic rate remains high.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Muscle is the most active tissue. It is the most active tissue. Now, if you want to get technical, by size, the brain is actually more active than muscle, but we have so much more muscle than we'd have brain tissue. And it is the most active tissue.
Mm-hmm. So how can we responsibly, boost our metabolism? We'll use general population terms here and lose weight at the same time. What's the most responsible way to do that?
I've never seen in my own research where losing fat or losing weight results in any meaningful increase in metabolic rate. The best thing that can happen, and my research kind of specializes in this area, is if you can maintain your muscle, your metabolic rate, that's a great indication that you have also maintained your lean muscle tissue. And that's really the best you can do. If you're going to be in a caloric deficit, anybody who's not resistance training, if you just have a normal person, not a fitness person, when they lose weight, their metabolism goes down. Happens mm-hmm. predictably.
Yes.
But these fitness people, bodybuilders or somebody like myself, when I lose weight or fitness enthusiasts, when we do this the right way, we target body fat, we maintain our muscle mass, and we maintain our metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. And again, the maintenance of metabolism and the muscle mass really sets you up for weight or fat loss maintenance. When you mess this up, you make it so hard on yourself to maintain the weight loss when you're done. Mm-hmm. And you say 50 pounds. I've never seen 50, but we've done research in bodybuilders post show. Mm-hmm. And in a small female, like a 20, it was like 26 pounds in a small female with a post show rebound in body weight. It was mm-hmm. amazing. And that's published. Everybody can see it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying to responsibly lose body fat and maintain muscle mass and actually just be more successful in general, we need to take our fat loss a little bit slower. We're not pushing to lose, you know, you see these 8-week transformations, right? Where it's like so-and-so lost 20 pounds in 8 weeks. And to me, that's not responsible. That's part of the reason I don't post transformation photos and do challenges and things like that, because I feel it's irresponsible to push someone really hard for 8 to 12 weeks and then post a transformation of a large amount of weight loss. I would rather take things down a little bit at a time over a long period of time.
Yeah, I just was the picture that went into my head when you said this 8 week transformation where it's a push. Show me that same person in 12 weeks.
They gain 10 pounds back almost immediately, or 10 pounds plus what they had already lost from what I've seen.
Yes. Now, where I would say where my mind is at now and where I think maybe the future of well, definitely the future of my research, but depending on how this comes out, the future of how people will approach this is very aggressive dieting for 2 weeks. And then you're off for two and then really aggressive for one. So it's still an 8 week period, but you've not been dieting the entire time. You've been aggressive for maybe three of those 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, the research that I'm relying on that seems to be very effective for targeting fat loss and maintaining muscle mass. But again, the key here is I like to think of it as like fat loss sprinting or high intensity interval dieting. Mm-hmm. So it's go hard, back off, put the, you know, grind again, back off. So when you look at over time, it's relatively a modest amount of fat loss over time, but it's just been accelerating slow, and I think the benefit of this, again, hypothetically, I don't have to think about dieting week after week after week. I'm just going to push hard for this week. Then I'm going to back off. Let me push again for maybe 10 days and then back off. So it's still a slow process when you look at an 8 week or 12 week period, but it was not consistent.
So I have a question that goes along with that, Bill, and that is, what does the research show as far as hunger signaling with that? So like ghrelin and leptin, for example, like, because you'll see if somebody goes into a larger caloric deficit over longer periods of time, then those signals become become stronger, right? It's harder and harder to resist eating food because you have your brain telling you need to eat more food. So in these smaller pushes and pulls, how does that affect hunger signaling?
Well, we don't have much research on this yet. So this is mostly theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
If you're losing body fat, which if that's the goal and somebody needs to lose body fat, leptin will be lowered. The leptin is produced, 95% of it or so is produced from fat cells. Ghrelin probably would go up during these pushes. But again, we're talking about such short periods that if the person, I'm using this motivation leverage, you can beat hunger for a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tried to extend this for, well, hey, I really like this. I see differences. Let me just do it for another 5 days. That's the mindset that you can't, no, that's when you're going to, I don't want to say fall off the wagon, but that's when you're going to succumb to this increased ghrelin and not be able to adhere to this. So leptin's going to go down if things are going right. Ghrelin probably, I assume, would go up. But again, I can't cite specific research or that I'm not aware of the specific research in that case.
Gotcha.
Let me say this, though. Right about the time you're like, oh, I'm really hungry. Stop. It's been 2 days of aggressive, or it's been 3 days. Stop, go back to your maintenance, get to the point where let's do this again. Again, this is all theoretical. This really hasn't been done cyclically yet. Mm-hmm. We have rapid fat loss studies. My lab is about to publish a study that was a 14-day aggressive, but these haven't been followed up with, like, your language has been this push-pull. We haven't had that data yet.
Gotcha. I was just curious. Yeah, sorry. That's just how I operate. I'm always like, okay, we're going to push a little while, then we're going to pull back and find maintenance again. Then we're going to push a little. And it historically has worked really well for me. But so that brings us to another subject. So we've got the new GLP-1 thing. It's the hot topic to talk about in the fitness industry. Actually, it's a hot topic to talk about anywhere because everybody you know, their uncle or sister or cousin or somebody is doing it, right?
Yeah.
And what I have seen anecdotally with my clients that have taken it on has not been positive in the end result. And I think that's beginning to become a trend where they're like, okay, well, if you're going to use one of these drugs, it kind of becomes a little bit more of a long-term lifetime type of thing, because I feel like the adaptations are negative when it comes to using it. And so then you have a heck of a rebound once you come off of it. So I'm curious to hear your take on these drugs, because I feel like in the case of obesity, where somebody really needs to lose some weight, they can definitely be a tool for the toolkit, but I think they need to be used very responsibly, which is not what's going on. And I also feel like that sets that person up for a rebound on the other side of it, because I feel like people are not only losing fat, they're losing a lot of lean tissue.
So yeah, I'm not in the world where I'm working with clients that are on these. So all my exposure to these medications, these drugs, has been their research. So studying how they work, the physiology, and then also observing just their effects on culture, which seems to be pretty impactful. Little side note here. I saw like 2 days ago that Oprah Winfrey apologized. Did you hear about her apology?
No.
So she apologized for her role in diet culture. And I'm pretty sure she is now affiliated with Weight Watchers, who prescribe, you know, who essentially prescribes the GLP-1 medications. Let's just call it Ozempic for now. And again, I'm not anti, I'll get into my thoughts on the drugs. I think they are a very good tool for some people, probably not a good option for others. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting that she apologized after probably making tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars from weight loss culture or diet culture, as she said, and now has, you know, embraced the medications. And I don't know. I don't know what I think, but I didn't like it. I'm like, it's something about it just didn't sit right. And again, no offense to her, but to apologize for something just didn't sit well with me. Mm-hmm. And I can't even put my finger on it. Now, to your question of what do I think about the drugs, I think kind of what you said, I don't want to live in a country where there's a lot of sickness, and we have an obesity epidemic, and that's a sickness. So if there's something that can be done to make my country healthier, whether that be through lifestyle or whether that be through a pill, if it can make people healthier, I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I really focus on, because I communicate with a lot of fitness professionals, is don't look at this as a threat, because I don't think it is. I think this is, now you're going to have a large population of people who have never been open to the idea of a fitness lifestyle, mm-hmm. who now for the first time in their lives will say, hey, I might now fit in one of those machines at the gym that I see, mm-hmm. or I might not be as self-conscious walking into a place. So I think if fitness professionals, let me say, if I were a fitness professional, I would have some segment of my business that would cater to people who are trying to stop taking the medications or that are on them. I would embrace it, because there's a lot of, you know, relatively a lot of people taking them, mm-hmm. or that don't like them and are going to come off of them and it might need our help. And then the whole thing that you said about the loss of lean tissue, it does seem like the limited research that I've read, there does seem to be a little bit greater losses of lean mass than what we would expect from just diet and from dieting itself. Mm-hmm. And that's where fitness professionals, that's where we shine. We know how to build muscle. Mm-hmm. So there's my positive spin on this. My negative spin on this is kind of what I think you mentioned this earlier. The marketing is to me, it's almost criminal, because there's people that have no business taking these. I'm talking, you know, somebody that might need to lose 10 pounds because they just want to look better in whatever outfit. They're not obese, that they do not have obesity, mm-hmm. and yet they're being I could have gotten this. I went to my local mall, outdoor mall, this was like last fall. I saw this clinic, and they had IVs, and I walk in and I realized, oh, this is a this is a weight loss clinic where they're, I could have got a prescription. So I talked to the person and the doctor came out. Now I didn't ask, but I'm pretty convinced I could have walked out that night with a prescription. And I mean, BMI, I'm probably obese, but I do carry more muscle, but I wasn't overweight. Like there's no reason I should have been a candidate for a prescription for Ozempic. Mm-hmm. So that's where, those are things that's where what I don't like about. So a lot of, I think there's potentially good for people that just will not or cannot use exercise and dieting at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe for them, there's a benefit. And then again, I get a little frustrated with the marketing towards anybody and everybody who wants to lose a few pounds.
Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that's what the trend is rather than using it to help people that are obese and just, I mean, let's be real, like people that are obese, there's some that have severe food addiction problems. You know, it's very hard to change once you get to a certain size, you can feel pretty hopeless too. I know that's another big thing. So with these drugs, I feel like this does give some of these people some hope. It does open up some new fitness lifestyle doors. I like that. It helps them change habits. But when you're seeing somebody that even needs to lose 20 or 30 pounds, I feel like a lot of times that it ends up being a negative crutch to those people because they go on it, they end up losing a lot of lean tissue, then they go off of it. And now you're looking at trying to properly reverse diet these people through extreme. And this has been my experience in it. When they go off the drug, their hunger signaling is extreme to the point of where they can barely keep themselves away from really high, food trigger foods. Like, you know, we're talking, I'll use one example because one of my clients, donuts, like, she's like, I couldn't drive by I think it was a Dunkin' Donuts or a Tim Hortons or whatever donut place they have where she's at without pulling in and eating something. I could not overcome the hunger signaling. And then when she would start eating, she couldn't stop. It was like, and this is not the first person that I've dealt with this with, but this was the most recent one. Unfortunately, so this was a client I had down over 80 pounds. And her doctor talked her into going on Wegovy. And we had done this 80 pound weight loss over the course of 2.5 years. So very gradually. And they talked her into going on Wegovy. And when she did, her weight loss actually stalled. And she wasn't seeing results. She was on it for probably 6 months. I was like, okay, well, let's make sure we're getting enough nutrition in, which I don't think was happening. You know, it's hard when you have something that affects your digestive processes and stuff. Also, it reduces hunger signaling, but it also slows motility, so you're not hungry. That's one of the mechanisms in which it works. And anyway, so she ended up going off of it. And when she did, she immediately started gaining weight. And then to add the icing to the cake, the hunger signaling was terrible, like extreme, not able to overcome type cravings that we had in under control prior to the drug. And I have found historically that's what's going on with a lot of these people is I'm seeing on lab work, I'm seeing thyroid downregulation, increases in reverse T3. And then I think the biggest part, which you can reverse out of, as you know, you can reverse out of a lot of these adaptations. But I think the one that really scares me is the actual hunger signaling where these people cannot stop eating once they come off the drug because they just feel like they are starving. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I've not heard that before. And to me, I would associate that with something that we both mentioned already was a loss of lean tissue from this. I mean, historically, that's what causes hyperphagia is a loss of lean tissue that manifests when the diet is over and when you're allowed to eat more. I just want to clarify what you're seeing is an appetite that is higher than what it was prior to starting the medication prior. It's accelerated.
Yes.
Yeah. That's, but there's an argument that you don't go off of the medication, which That's all that's going to do is be a selling point to the
Well, and that's what I'm seeing throughout the fitness industry. Someone was actually comparing it to the opiate crisis the other day, and I thought it was really interesting. And I sat and thought about it, and I was like, holy cow, they were like, they didn't think this was going to be a problem, right? And they gave it to people, and then they come to find out it's something that you almost get stuck on. And it's kind of the same with these medications people are starting to find where, okay, if you plan on being on a low dose of it forever to control this appetite, then you're good to go, right? But most people want to be able to come off of these things and live a normal lifestyle. And it can be very hard. I mean, we got with this particular client of mine, we got through this, but not before gaining 40 pounds back. So, and this particular client, it was extreme. Other ones, this was the first one I had to handle. Other ones, now I know what's coming and I prepare them for it. I'm like, listen, you're going to have an insatiable appetite and we're going to have to work through that. So we have a little bit of preparation now, but the weight gain still happens because what I've seen is just such a significant amount of lean tissue loss that our BMR is now pretty low compared to where it would have been had you have responsibly pulled calories down, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I guess I don't know what the word is. I'll just say shocked. This physician working with your client would have known that they had lost 80 pounds and that whatever they were doing was working.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was this particular client, did they still have significant amounts of body weight to lose? Like,
Yeah, she when we started, she was up in the almost 300 and we were down to 220. So she still had quite a bit to lose, but it was happening. And we were in this place where you could take a diet break and no weight gain. I mean, not significant amounts of weight gain. I think we took 3 months off for a summer and she gained maybe 5 pounds.
Just you explaining this still, that to me is a very workable, like that's working. Mm-hmm. We don't need to introduce anything else into this, but yet they did.
Well, and I think part of it, there's been such a huge push for it. But so the big thing you're hearing a lot of physicians saying, well, is this lowers your A1C, right? That's a big argument that is going along with this. And this particular client still had a higher A1C, obviously still were losing weight, correct? So there's lab markers were significantly improved, but still had a higher A1C, still had higher blood glucose, not in the diabetes range, but still borderline, you know, pre-diabetic area. And their argument is it lowers your A1C. Well, in my eyes, it lowers your A1C because you're losing weight. So we're seeing, you know, these markers, obviously that's going to improve if you're losing more weight. So I think the argument can also be made that yes, it does lower your A1C, but so does any significant weight loss.
Yes. Yeah. All right. But at least you explained something that they may be focusing on, a clinical health marker rather than than the weight loss alone.
And let alone, even then I would have looked at the history. So when I do all my labs on my clients, I have a graph going and I look and see what's making improvements and what's not and what needs to be addressed. And as long as we are moving the scale in a positive direction, I don't worry because I'm like, listen, we're going in the correct direction. And that's actually something that I really focus on versus scale weight with my clients is health markers, because I believe health markers manifest into that physique that you're looking for. But anyways, with this particular client, still had an elevated A1C. And I think their argument was, oh, well, in the studies, this lowers your A1C. So let's give it a try. Well, you know, I think that's correct for weight loss in general.
Yeah. I'm curious, too. Did your just try to speak globally? Mm-hmm. Did your clients that are taking Wegovy or Ozempic, mm-hmm. did they have side effects that were like that they couldn't stay on it, or they weren't
yes
too bad?
Yes. So I actually had one client, she was on it for a short period of time, a couple of months, and her digestive, we're talking nausea, extreme nausea, and it was on a low dose of it too. I think Wegovy is the low dose one. Anyway, nausea and constipation, you know, lack of motility, and finally ended up going off of it just because her digestion was so messed up the whole time and at a low dose. So, and to me, our digestion is a huge part of our overall health. So in some of these people where it's causing this digestive distress, I think you're only further impacting your ability to lose weight efficiently.
Yes. Okay. And then just to clarify, you've had other clients with no side effects, like they, mm-hmm. they tolerated it very well and they lost weight and all seems good for some others.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's the coming off of it that seems to be the problem, honestly. And well,
that needs to be researched because that's a huge, yeah, that's.
Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it's due to metabolic adaptation. Obviously, I'm seeing on labs, I'm seeing the thyroid downregulation. I'm seeing if they are not postmenopausal, which most of my clients, interestingly enough, are postmenopausal that are using the drug. So I can't really speak to those that are in the premenopausal or perimenopausal stage. So only one person have I seen, and that was a person that had the digestive distress and had to go off of it. So we didn't really have enough time to do some anecdotal research on that. I'm seeing it most in postmenopausal women. So you're not getting that hormonal change. You're mostly seeing it in thyroid and stuff.
So and I'm going to assume that in 50s and 60s are the typical age ranges of these clients?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where they get into that when they get into that postmenopausal stage and they begin to struggle with weight loss, then they decide to try out those drugs is what I am seeing.
Okay. And then one more question.
Yeah.
Are a lot of these women on HRT as well, or yes, some, no others, none of them?
No, none of the women that have done it have been on HRT.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just from a research, at least that's not another variable. So that's
no.
Interesting.
No, none of them are on HRT. And honestly, if I had it my way, I would have probably pushed for the HRT first to get all of the health markers aligned and then seeing if they had significant weight loss from that versus going on one of those drugs. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. And then my last question, thanks for
educating. Sure, Bill.
They're paying out of pocket for these medications?
Yes, and many of these medications, to my understanding, are in the $300 and $400 a month range.
Okay, so in theory, if they can't get prescribed HRT, they could be using this disposable income to pay for the HRT if they so chose. So I'm just trying to.
Yes,
there's 100%. Always this finance part of things. So
absolutely, and that's a great point I didn't think about. But yes, you're correct. I know I work pretty closely with a lot of several functional medicine doctors, depending on the state. And one of the ones that I work with that I send people to locally, people are always like, "Oh, well, she's so expensive." To me, she's quite affordable, I think. But you know, that's what I see though, is I see people would happily shell out $400 a month for a drug that will make it so that they don't have to think about food or really do anything, right? Versus getting their health markers aligned or hiring a coach, you know, because the one thing I can tell you that these GLP-1s don't do is they're not your life coach. They're not there every couple weeks or every day telling you, supporting you and helping you make good choices and learn. I think there's a huge value to coaching from a learning aspect. If you have a good coach, that person is going to teach you, they're going to support you, and they're going to help you get to your goals. And a drug doesn't do that.
Yes. And very little side effects from a coach.
Well, hopefully not, but some coaches out there, I think there can be some side effects from them from a mental health standpoint. So, yeah. Anyway, Bill, so we are running low on time now. So if there's one thing in your research that you have found that you want to convey to somebody that is looking to lose weight and keep it off, what would that be?
Oh, let's see. The one thing, I would say have a patient mentality. Don't be in a hurry to lose weight. And I almost always gravitate towards, once I get somebody's goal, hey, I want to lose 10 pounds or I want to lose 50 pounds. I say, okay, here's our 52 week plan. And what? I'm like, hey, if you lose even a pound a week for a lot of people, you'd be dead in a year. So I always want to over communicate the the amount of time it's going to take for you to do this in a way that becomes sustainable. Mm-hmm. So we have to lose it. And then we wanted you to have a physiology and a mindset where you will maintain this so that you can just, and again, I'm speaking to myself here. I have no problem losing body fat. I struggle with maintaining the loss of body fat. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so is that, there, based on your research, is there a responsible amount to lose per week?
Yeah, based on scale weight, what I've found is if you're losing more than 1% of your current body weight per week, that's a good indication that you are losing lean tissue. So, and if I look at all of the examples of rebody recomposition where people are actually gaining lean tissue and losing body fat, it's a very low rate of weight loss based on scale weight. We're talking like 0.25% per week. So that's why it's important. Weigh yourself every day, unless there's, you know, unless there's some disorder or some mental stress mm-hmm. issues that keep you from doing that. Take weekly averages, take monthly averages, gauge your process on a monthly or at least a weekly basis. That really helps with seeing, oh, I have made progress. Because day to day, you never see it. You think that this isn't, I remember myself last year, I did a case study on myself and I'm a fat loss researcher. I remember at three specific points, 221, 219, and I think 216, or no, 219, 216, 211, losing my body weight. I'm thinking, this is embarrassing. This isn't working. And I'm a fat loss researcher and I'm going to publish my case study. And now I look back at the data. I'm like, what was I thinking? I can't even see the data. I can't even see what I was thinking. But I remember making a note saying, this isn't working. And I wanted to be able to process this when I was done. And I look at the data now, I'm like, everything was working great. But in my head, probably because I looked at the scale one day during the 219, like it's not moving. It was, if I just would have looked at it over a 2 week period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I tell people that all the time. Look at your averages. Don't look at your dailies. Don't even, I mean, between 1 and 5 pound shifts can happen. It's like, I mean, I use Trainerize for my clients, right? And I have it kind of like hacked a little bit as far as like other things go. But I love, my favorite thing in Trainerize is the graph for fat loss. Oh, because cool. You can see it. It's like, and if you look in the short, like if you put it at 1 month, you can put it at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And these clients, a really cool one is the one that I've worked with for several years. You can see it, like if you look at a small window, it looks like it's up. But if you pull it out to 3 months, you can see it's up, but then it's down. You pull it out to 6 months, you can see it's up, but then it's like, it's a downhill, you know, you pull it out to a year or 2 years and you can see the whole graph going up and down. And it's just so satisfying to look at because, you know, what you may have considered a loss as far as, you know, not winning, a loss during a week because you're like, well, I gained 5 pounds, may have just been a fluctuation that ended in you actually losing 5 pounds. So it's really cool to look at that. It's one of my favorite things.
And I would be very surprised if there's ever a week average that would actually show a 5 pound increase.
Yeah.
That would be rare. Day to day, yes. So yeah, that's the secret. That's the one thing I would impart to people. So like, make sure that you have perspective of time when you're in this fat loss journey.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, if people want to find you and follow your Instagram or whatever it might be, which I highly suggest because you, I love your little questions, true or false. I'm always testing myself with those. I'm like, oh, am I right? Oh, cool. You know, like the egg one got me the other day. I was like, what's the answer? I was like, what's the answer going to be to this? Like, I'm kind of curious now, you know, but lots of great information on there. How do they go about finding you?
My Instagram is Bill Campbell, PhD, and currently that's the only place where you'll find me.
Awesome. No YouTubes or anything, huh?
No, not that.
I love it. Well, I really, really appreciate you joining me. I love your energy and everything that you bring to things. Keep doing what you're doing, and I can't wait to hear more about what you learn.
Yes. Thank you for educating me today, too.
No. Well, hopefully, no problem. Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for tuning in. To learn more about me, my online programs, or to inquire about coaching, please visit www.connienightingale.com. And remember, nothing in the contents of this show is intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any illness, and it is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult with your primary care physician before implementing any new health protocols.